Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We start with livestock news today. The National Pork Producers Council and the American Farm Bureau Federation petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to take their case against California's Proposition 12. Chad Smith has more.
The ballot initiative would ban the sale of pork from hogs raised outside the state that don't meet California's arbitrary production standards. Michael Formica is assistant vice president and general counsel for the NPPC. He says California is attempting to tell hog producers outside the state how to run their farms.
California is now reaching out far beyond its borders and not just controlling how pork would be produced inside the state of California, and there is no pork produced there, but reaching across the country and prohibiting the sale of pork in California if it doesn't meet these very prescriptive standards that they have put in place. So 99.9% of the pork in the country is produced outside of California, and this is their attempt to reach out and control how farmers in the Midwest or in the Southeast raise their hogs.
The Humane Society of the U.S. was behind the Prop 12 initiative in California, justifying it through food safety and animal cruelty concerns. He says neither justification will be met if this initiative goes through, especially when it comes to group housing and gestation crates for sows.
The piglets who were raised elsewhere, maybe many states thousands of miles away, there might be a food safety issue there. It is so ludicrous. California hasn't even defended it and admits that there's no basis to it. Sows are very large animals. They're very aggressive animals. After giving birth to their piglets and nursing them, they need time to recover. What this large mother animal doesn't need is in that recovery phase to be sent into like a World Wrestling Federation match with a bunch of other angry pigs who are all trying to beat up on her.
The bill for pork farmers around the country to make the necessary changes to sell products into California would be enormous.
In the billions of dollars, yes. We've had some economic analyses done on this, and it's tough to come up with an exact figure, but the most recent one we had was estimating up to $3,500 per sow to make these changes. For a typical size operation, it's like $15-16 million investment that you have to make with no guarantee that you're going to recoup that investment either. The farmer who's had to make this investment gets stuck holding the bag, gets stuck holding and having to pay for all of this for a philosophical preference that California voters might have been duped into and ultimately isn't going to lead to what they claim they want, which is increased welfare.
Formica talks about the next steps in the process.
The Supreme Court does not have to accept the case. In any one year, there could be as many as 8,000 petitions to the Supreme Court. They get to pick and choose which ones they want to take up. There have been a number of other petitions that have challenged ballot initiatives like this in the past or these efforts by states to reach across state lines. Most of them, nearly all of them, have been rejected. We spent a lot of time looking at all the reasons why and designing a case and a campaign that we think will appeal to the Supreme Court.
He says American consumers will eventually bear the cost of Prop 12 through higher prices at the grocery store. Chad Smith reporting.
There is mounting evidence to show that we are on the downside of the beef cattle cycle. Gary Crawford reports.
For the beef cattle industry this year and next, one economist says we are definitely in the herd reduction phase of the cattle cycle.
We're expecting inventory numbers to be coming down. We're about a 2% decline in 2021 and about 1% in 2022.
That's Caitlin McCulloch with the Livestock Marketing Information Center. She told an Outlook forum put on by AgriPulse the other day that for 2022, this herd reduction will bring, of course,
production down for cattle, prices up. That's largely what we have in 2023 as well.
And the latest USDA report on cattle feedlot inventories would lend some credence to that forecast. USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham says
the number on cattle on feed on September 1st was just over 11.2 million head, which was about 1% below a year ago.
USDA's current 2022 forecast is for beef output to fall by about 3%, average prices for steers to go up about 5%. USDA will come up with a new forecast, though, October 12th. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
As the World Dairy Expo is underway in Madison, Wisconsin this week, event organizers announced a new schedule starting in 2022. World Dairy Expo Communications Manager Katie Schmidt explains.
The schedule is going to look a little different in 2022 for World Dairy Expo, and some would say it's changes that are well overdue. Others were caught a little off guard by it. So in 2022, World Dairy Expo will be a six-day event, starting on Sunday with youth contests. Monday is when the dairy cattle show will begin, and Tuesday is when the trade show begins. And then everything ends all cohesively on Friday. So a lot of the features that we love at World Dairy Expo are back in 22. They're just going to have a new home on a different day.
Schmidt says the changes come after requests for a refreshed schedule and thorough evaluation.
It's been a change that's been requested for quite some time, especially by our commercial exhibitors, but also in the Dairy Cattle Show, we've been requested to look at the show schedule from a time frame just to understand, is there something we could be doing different or better? And that made it in our strategic plan back in 2017. When we canceled the show last year, we had time on our hands. So really evaluating these pieces of Expo objectively got kind of some feet underneath it. And at the end of the day, they came up with a plan that they thought was viable, and we're moving forward with it, and we're excited about it.
The 2021 World Dairy Expo continues through Saturday. Learn more at worlddairyexpo.com. Meanwhile, Dairy Management, Inc. announced this week that Tom Gallagher has decided to conclude his 30-year tenure as CEO and devote more time to teaching and other opportunities. Barbara O'Brien, president of DMI and CEO of the Innovation Center for U.S. Dairy, has been named by the board of directors as the next CEO. The board leadership, Gallagher and O'Brien, will work on a transition plan, and Gallagher has committed his support through the transition timeframe. O'Brien's knowledge and experience with the dairy industry provide a seamless transition and a steady continuation of the checkoff's value to dairy farmers. The future of agriculture relies on experts in all production fields, from the farm to manufacturing and retail. At South Dakota State University, students are experiencing the dairy supply chain firsthand and preparing for their careers in the industry. Miles Ramsey shares the story from Holstein Association USA.
Dairy production is a source of pride at South Dakota State University. It is only one of two schools in the nation offering a dairy manufacturing degree program. Students gain hands-on learning experience producing dairy products and are set up for success at some of the dairy industry's top manufacturing companies. Vikram Mistry with the university's College of Agriculture, Food, and Environmental Sciences.
Students I had 30 years ago and what they're doing in the industry today is incredible. Wherever you go, you'll see a lot of our alumni that are making just huge influence on the dairy industry.
Milk produced at the SDSU dairy farm is used at a student-run dairy manufacturing facility right on campus that produces milk, cheese, and ice cream for consumption by the student population and consumers. Registered Holsteins have a storied history for the university, too.
It's been an interesting history. Back in 1912, one of our Holsteins, College Belle Wayne, she was the top producer west of the Mississippi. And then we had the opportunity to take her around on a train to show everybody, you know, what a top-producing Holstein looks like.
As the industry evolved, dairy producers adapted breeding strategies to produce the kind of milk required to manufacture high-quality dairy products.
For cheese, you need proteins. And so the Holstein breeders responded to that by breeding Holsteins for protein and milk production. And so Holstein really has been very proactive in responding to the needs of the dairy industry.
Mistry says the future of the dairy industry looks bright as the growing global population demands more protein in creative ways.
There are just an amazing number of possibilities for developing new products from the same basic milk.
For Holstein Association USA, I'm Miles Ramsey.
We have news from the rest of the ag industry right after this.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Welcome back. Here's your news for today. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack Wednesday announced a $3 billion comprehensive set of investments to address challenges facing farmers and ranchers. USDA says the investments will support drought resilience and response, animal disease prevention, market disruption relief, and purchase food for school nutrition programs. The support will be made available via the Commodity Credit Corporation. Specifically, the package includes $500 million each for drought, African swine fever, and market disruptions, and up to $1.5 billion to provide assistance to help schools respond to supply chain disruptions. What changes, if any, occurred in household food security percentages year over year? Per USDA's annual look at this topic, Rod Bain reports.
The Agriculture Department's Household Food Security in America report series has looked at this and related subject matter since 1995.
And we've been trying to assess the extent to which households are able to put enough food on the table for all their members. On an annual basis, we look at food security by different household characteristics. We also look at food insecurity across the states. We look at food spending by food security status, and we look at participation in nutrition assistance programs by food security status.
And USDA economic researcher Alicia Coleman-Jensen says for this year's report, capturing data from 2020.
In 2020, the prevalence of food insecurity was unchanged from 2019. The prevalence was 10.5% of U.S. households. In 2020, 3.9% of U.S. households had very low food security, and that was not significantly different from 4.1% in 2020.
She acknowledges some might be surprised by this data, given the kind of year 2020 was financially for some. But she explains.
The COVID-19 pandemic affected public health and the economy, and there were a number of changes to federal, state, and local policies, programs, and benefits. There were a number of changes to existing nutrition assistance programs and additions of programs, and there were responses by charitable organizations.
Plus, substantial increases in cash assistance and unemployment benefits in 2020, despite little or no change in primary category numbers. Coleman-Jensen notes year-over-year increases in areas such as
the prevalence of household food insecurity, meaning that either adults or children or both were food insecure, increased for all households with children from 13.6% in 2019 to 14.8% in 2020.
Also,
in 2020, children along with adults suffered instances of very low food security in 0.8% of households with children. That's up from 0.6% in 2019.
In addition, a special section of the report looks at food insecurity of households by employment effects of the COVID-19 pandemic.
We looked at the prevalence of food insecurity in the 30-day period from mid-November to mid-December 2020 and found that food insecurity was substantially higher than the national average. We found that food insecurity was substantially higher among households with a reference person who was unable to work because of the pandemic. 16.4% of those households were food insecure. And households with a reference person who was not employed and was preventing from looking for work because of the pandemic also had a higher food insecurity rate. 20.4% of those households were food insecure in the 30-day period.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
A federal judge in Minnesota this month ordered a class action lawsuit against JBS, Tyson, National Beef, and Cargill to proceed. In the case, National Farmers Union is among the plaintiffs alleging that America's four largest beef packers conspired to suppress the price of cattle and increase the price of beef. NFU President Rob LaRue states, quote, "We're pleased the effort to restore pricing transparency and competitiveness to the cattle markets is moving forward in the courtroom." The health of the farm economy is improving due to a shot of rising exports and a booster of high commodity prices. Gary Crawford has more.
When COVID really kicked in last year, many experts were predicting a disastrous cut in demand for and exports of U.S. ag products, but
hasn't been that way. As a matter of fact, demand, again, trade demand, has been incredibly robust.
Not go bust, but
robust.
Robust. Agriculture Department Chief Economist Seth Meyer telling an Outlook Forum the other day that instead of the expected recession in demand for ag products,
trade has become record large in 2021 and expected to grow a little bit from there, setting a new record.
$173.5 billion fiscal year 21, $177.5 billion in 22, partly on higher volumes, mostly on higher prices. One reason?
Both in the U.S. and abroad, carryout stocks are tightening,
helping bring commodity prices up and, of course, farm income up. Last year, of course, a lot of that income coming from the government's trade disruption and COVID assistance payments, but this year,
we're pulling those government payments down very quickly, and yet farm income is rising because we're getting more dollars from the marketplace than we're losing from those government payments. That's a pretty good place to be.
Net farm income this year could be the highest in 8 years, and that's not the only measure of the health of the farm economy. Jackson Takash is chief economist at Farmer Mac, and he told the forum that from a credit perspective, the signs of an improving farm economy are pretty striking.
Chapter 12 bankruptcies, for example, by percentage of farms or by just number of farms going through that very difficult Chapter 12 process, those are both down dramatically. A lot of that has to do with some of the excess cash that came from the government support program payments, but then also followed up by really strong commodity prices this year. So both of those things helping cure some of these delinquency and bankruptcy issues that were popping up in 2020.
And also, interest rates continue at the lowest levels in decades. But don't worry, there are still some things to worry about. Don't have to worry about that. Back in the 70s and 80s, I created a sound to sort of describe on radio what was going on then. My impression of a farmer being squeezed by falling commodity prices and rising production costs. And USDA's Seth Meyer says it looks like commodity prices are settling down, input costs for producers rising fast.
That is somewhat of a natural correction that I worry about, that producers will get squeezed.
And he says production expenses for this year will be 7% higher than 2020, higher still in 2022, with major hikes expected for the three Fs, fertilizers, feed, and most of all, fuel. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service this week announced that the American bumblebee, whose populations have plummeted by nearly 90%, may warrant Endangered Species Act protection. The announcement kicks off a one-year status assessment of the species. A Federal Register document published Wednesday follows a petition by the Center for Biological Diversity and others. The center claims the species decline has resulted from multiple concurrent threats, including habitat loss, pesticides, disease, climate change, and competition from non-native honeybees. The organization claims pesticide use, especially the widespread use of neonic insecticides, reduces survival and harms reproduction, as well as bumblebee immune systems. That's our news for today. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. The 2021 AgriPulse Ag Outlook Forum was held last week in Kansas City, Missouri. The Ag Economy Panel was a key session during the forum. It was moderated by Sarah Wyant, AgriPulse founder.
So next is going to be our opportunity to look ahead for the ag economy. And we're going to have an entire panel focused on this topic. But our lead speaker is Dr. Seth Meyer, the chief economist at USDA. We're so fortunate that we had not only Secretary Vilsack, but Dr. Meyer with us. And after he gets done presenting, then I'm going to call on each of our other panelists to make remarks. And then we're going to have time for questions and answers after that. So Seth might not be a stranger to many of you because he has been very involved in looking forward for American agriculture and, in fact, global agriculture. He was appointed USDA's chief economist in 2020 after having spent 2 years previously at the department. Prior to that, he was a research professor and associate professor for the Food and Ag Policy Research Institute at the University of Missouri. And prior to that, at FAPRI, he was the head of the World Outlook Board. He previously served as an economist with the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, and as a visiting scholar at several research institutions. He also hails from the great state of Iowa, where he went to Iowa State for his bachelor's and master's, and later on, PhD in the University of Missouri. So please help me welcome Dr. Seth Meyer.
All right, the first thing I'll say is thank you all. It's nice to be out in front of civilized company. So I appreciate getting out of my house. I'm living down the road in Columbia, Missouri. Went off a chance to go back to D.C. I went for a little bit, and I said, I don't mind Missouri. Got plenty of meat and plenty of gasoline. I'll just hang out here for a while. So I've been working remotely from Columbia, Missouri. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, there was a small error in there. I've been chief economist not since 2020. I've been chief economist since 2021. So I haven't been chief economist at USDA all that long. I'm going to give you a really quick market overview. And the reason I'm going to give you a quick market overview is because we got some really great panelists who know more than I do. So they can jump in and give you all the details. All right. You all going to put this monitor so I can see the slides, or do I need to look over my shoulder? I can look over my shoulder, that's fine. You'll see me wandering around anyway. So I'll start out here. You know, we have these discussions, and somebody asked me, are we in a boom? Somebody on USDA radio, are we in a boom? And I remind folks where we were at a little over a year ago and what folks' sentiment was in the market a little over a year ago. I show this in all my presentations. Remember where we were prior to August of 2020. Okay, so this in my mind is an important context here. We've seen a big run on commodities since August 2020. So what I have here is November and December futures here for corn, beans, and hogs. And look, and the line there represents August, right? So that's where we've been. We've had a lot of gain since then. I think it's hard for us to remember where we were, say, June of 2020. All right, maybe not for some of you, but remember that. And I put this is a somewhat confusing chart here, but I put these arrows in here to remind you also of what happened during that period. Okay, so I've broken it out into a couple of periods to show you, since August 2020, our idea of how big the crops were started to shrink, and at the same time, you know, normally you think, okay, size of the crop is shrinking, we need to start rationing demand. So demand should be moving down. But look at what trade demand was doing at the same time we were shrinking those crops. Trade demand was increasing in volume as those crops were getting smaller. So that is obviously a very big feature about where we're at. And to put that trade in context, you know, when we first started when we first were entering issues of COVID, it was very much, what is COVID going to look like? What is COVID's impacts on the ag sector going to be? And, you know, part of the initial reaction was, we're going to have an economic slowdown, a contraction in trade, and this is going to be bad for agriculture. It's going to be like the Great Recession there, which is your big dip there in trade.
hasn't been that way. As a matter of fact, demand, again, trade demand, has been incredibly robust. And as a matter of fact, trade has become record large. So our anticipated value of U.S. agricultural trade, record large in 2021, and expected to grow a little bit from there, setting a new record. Okay. So agricultural trade, as we heard in that video that just played, absolutely important for where we're at today. And part of this is on the back of a big rebound in China, right? A big rebound in the volume of trade with China. They got as low as number 5, back to number 1 strong. So this is obviously an important factor in terms of our trade demand. Now let's jump forward a little bit and say, okay, that's where we were kind of, the theme of things coming out from August to 2020, where are we at? We're having a Western drought. You heard the secretary talk about that. You can see it impact certain crops, certain acreage, certain livestock groups. It is an important factor to some extent in what we're observing in some commodities, okay? And I think the other part of this story, I talked to you about very strong trade demand, but overall, global demand being very strong as well, too. Why do we have rising prices? Because both in the U.S. and abroad, carry-out stocks are tightening. We've got a tightening stock situation. And you can see here, hey, we've been bouncing around with consumption or production of both corn and beans, sometimes production exceeding consumption and vice versa, and always having plenty of wheat. Well, now we've got all three in a situation where consumption is expected to exceed production at this marketing year we just ended, and now we're into the new marketing year, hoping we'll get to ease that tight stock situation at a global level. Okay. And the other interesting part of this is the response in area by producers this last year to very high commodity prices. Okay, so I find this to be a very interesting result in terms of how did producers respond. So what you have here on the right is principal crop planted area. And I really think about 2010 to 2014 being very high prices. Then prices come down. We had a couple of past years of prevent plant issues. That's why principal crop area was so low. This year we don't have an issue with prevent plant, and yet we still didn't see a big rebound in planted area. Some of that is Western drought. Some of it, but that isn't enough to explain everything that's going on. So I think that this is it's an interesting discussion that I think is still evolving here. But folks initially thinking we'd have much greater area than that. Okay, so let's jump in and let's talk a little bit about the major commodities, and then I want to talk a little bit about demand, and then we'll pass it off to folks who can really talk about all the details. I show this because I've been talking about wheat. But this isn't just a wheat graph, it's also a canola graph saying, hey, we've got some supply issues, not just here in the United States when it comes to Western drought, but when it comes to wheat, also in places like Canada. So this is both a wheat and a canola graph. And when we talk about soybeans, keep that in mind as well, too, about how the canola market looks in Canada. Here's the other supplies that have really, so I think early on, since August 2020, we had a really good run on corn and a good run on beans. Wheat was being kind of driven or pulled along for the ride. And all of a sudden you see something like this, which starts to give wheat its own legs, which is, hey, that Russian wheat crop didn't turn out so good. And we came out and put out an estimate in August, and folks said, you're way too low, it's not that bad. Trade is kind of converging on this number of a pretty bad Russian wheat crop, and that's what's provided some support for that crop in recent terms. So when you look at this in terms of overall global production, I think all I'd really have you look at here is that ending stock number where after maybe 4 or 5 or 6 years of growing carryout stocks for wheat, we're tightening up the wheat market as well too on a global level. So it's not just corn and beans, it's also wheat. But there has been, in all fairness, a very big difference in the outcomes for our wheat crop between winter and spring wheat, right? The winter wheat crop, not bad in the United States, spring wheat crop almost entirely in drought. Okay, so when you look at this, again, thinking about the U.S. balance for wheat as well, too, tightening down U.S. wheat markets, so something that we haven't done in quite a while. And you can go through and you can see that, you know, having to ration exports a little bit, having a challenging export environment, and prices rising and cutting the carryout stocks for wheat a little bit. Let's talk about corn, and let's talk about, we'll talk about corn, soybeans, and then a little on the demand side. Shaping up to be kind of a trend yield year for corn in terms of the United States, still giving you the second biggest corn crop on record. But let's talk a little bit about demand. I think when we go back and you think about the mood and sentiment in the market in June and July last year, or May, June and July of last year, that is a driver of the negative sentiment, or one of the drivers of the negative sentiment early last summer, right? What does ethanol demand grind look like? And clearly we've been going through several years of somewhat modest growth relative to what we saw earlier. But this decline in motor gasoline consumption really hitting ethanol demand hard, right? As folks, I had the same tank of gas in my car for 3 months. Okay, that's clearly a negative for gasoline demand. But on the other side of that, we've seen tremendous export demand for U.S. corn as well, too. And one of them is a focus by the Chinese on importation of corn. And I don't want to speak definitively about the Chinese market because I think we lack a lot of understanding and insight into the Chinese market because they're not transparent. But one of the things that we do see is they've been importing a lot of corn as, when you think about corn and corn equivalents, they've gone through periods of time where they've bringing in a lot of corn and corn equivalents. By corn equivalents, I mean things you can feed like corn, so sorghum, DDGs, barley, other things, and you can see that back in 2015, they were bringing these products in at the same time they were building their internal stocks. They were building internal stocks at a very fast rate while importing a bunch of things that feed as corn. And you could see this happen and evolve where corn's coming in and that corn, the Chinese say, no, that has a GMO trait we don't like. Then DDGs start flowing in, no, those DDGs have a trait we don't like. And then you can see other things. Well, okay, sorghum's non-GMO and doesn't have a tariff, and so it began to flow. And in this situation, it's both bigger in terms of corn equivalents and very corn-focused. Okay, they're still bringing in lots of other stuff as well, too. So there is demand, but we don't have complete transparency in terms of what their domestic stocks are. Are they building stocks? What does things look like internally? Okay, and so when you look at this, you know, when we look at here, we've had an excellent export year last year, so we might lose some of that export market as the Ukrainian crop comes back. So some of last year's demand, maybe it eases a little bit because we've got more competition from other countries. Ethanol demand, maybe a little bit of a rebound. Second largest crop, a little bit of an expansion of carryout stocks there. And when you look at prices in this, remember, these are prices received by farmers, so they lag because it includes forward-priced grain. The grain is priced when it's delivered. It's counted as that period in time, okay? So farmers may be missing out on some of that run-up in prices or getting it as prices ran up, now maybe being able to capture a bit more of that.
We continue right after this. Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlante is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlante wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Welcome back. We continue now with coverage of the 2021 AgriPulse Ag Outlook Forum's Ag Economy Panel.
We'd really like to move on with our next presenter, but keep in mind, this is a great opportunity to ask some of the leading economists that are going to be with us here today any question you want. So please keep entering your questions into the Slido Q&A. Our next panelist is Jackson Takich, who is the chief economist at Farmer Mac. His focus includes quantitative analysis of credit, interest rate, and other market-based risks, as well as monitoring conditions of the agricultural economy, operational information systems, and statistical analysis programming. He's a Kentucky native who joined the Farmer Mac team in 2005, working in research, credit, and the underwriting departments. Jackson is going to join us virtually, so please welcome Jackson to the screens.
Farm finances, I'm going to talk about the capital markets in 21 and a lot of the healing that's happened for many of the reasons that Secretary Vilsack talked about and Dr. Myers talked about. They flow all the way through to the farm balance sheets and some of those conditions that are out there in the farm economy. So let's jump right in. You can't talk about farm finances without first talking about interest rates. And right now, farmers and ag producers are experiencing some of the lowest interest rates they've ever experienced in since we've been measuring, really, farm finances. So I've got some great data from the Kansas City Fed up on the screen in front of you, which you can see here. If you're talking about real estate, if you're talking about operating lines, if you're talking about machinery, equipment, whatever it is you're talking about, you've got some of the lowest interest rates that we've experienced in the sector, in the ag and rural economy. Those are hovering near that bottom. So we're not seeing them pick up like we maybe saw some of the other sectors. So you saw residential rates pick up in the last 6 months. You've seen treasury rates pick up in the last few, you know, say 3 to 4 months. We're seeing that consistently low across the capital stack in ag finance. Now, it's hard to see it going, you know, a whole lot lower, right? 100, 200, 300 basis points, much lower. However, there is some room for compression there. If you think about things like all this intense competition between lenders and borrowers out there in the farm real estate. So there's a lot of opportunities, I think, to get some lower interest rates across the board in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months. But it's going to be a lot smaller than some of the more dramatic decreases we've seen over the last, say, 12 to 24 months. Now, interest rates have a direct impact on real estate, right? So the lower the cost of capital, the lower the cost of financing, the more people are willing to pay generally for the asset stack. And that's what we're seeing in the farm real estate numbers. This is a series that's released every year by the USDA over at NASS, great group over there at NASS. The June area survey, they come out every August and say, this is the total US ag real estate perspective. They do it state by state. And it was a great year in 21 for farm real estate. So in total, it was about a 7% gain. Over 2020 numbers. That's after several years of sort of steady eddy gains across the farm real estate landscape. And we've seen the biggest gains right in the heart of the Midwest. So where you guys are in Missouri, you know, you're at 8.8% increase year over year in farm real estate. And I'm sure if you're out there in the marketplace doing deals, buying land or selling land, you're probably like, absolutely, it's up 8% because it has been a very active marketplace. We're also seeing a lot of gains out west. So there's some drought issues at play. Some of these increases, I think, have to do with the land that has water is gaining very quickly in value, and land that doesn't is kind of losing value. So you're seeing a separation between the has water and doesn't have water, and policy is going to drive that difference as we go forward. We're not done talking about water in the Midwest either. Maybe this year isn't a year that we talk about it a tremendous amount. It's been fairly wet across the central Midwest and down into the Southeast. But water is going to be a factor that drives real estate in the next 5 to 10 years. Modest gains in the Southeast, I think, you know, that could turn around here in the next, you know, a few months to maybe a year. You could see some additional pressure in the Southeast as the conditions that Dr. Meyer talked about in terms of profitability and cash flow and higher cash receipts all that kind of works its way from the Midwest down to the Southeast. But rents are also starting to tick up. So that's kind of the flip side. If you're renting land, you're starting to see those costs inch up a little bit. If you're an investor, you like to see that. But if you're maybe the one paying the rent, you hope that moderates just a little bit. So we're starting to see a 5-7% tick up in rents all across the Midwest. Not so much out west or in the Southeast. So it's really in the core Corn Belt area you're starting to see those rents pick up. Activity remains pretty elevated, so it's a seasonal slowdown, but you're still seeing a lot of activity all across the Midwest when you think about those grain markets and land that's coming up for sale through auction or just through traditional sales. Now, farm finances in general, that outlook has stabilized quite a bit. There's two metrics I like to look at, so I'll throw them up on the screen for you. The first one is capital, working capital to expenses. So think of this as how much dry powder is out there in the sector to cover things like expenses. The historical average, so the level we like to think is a good safe level in the sector as a whole, it's about 30 cents on the dollar. So you have 30 cents of working capital for every dollar of expenses that you have going out the door. We're not quite back there yet. So, you know, I'd say the healing has begun. We're not completely healed. So the working capital on farms is starting to pick up. We're off that low of about 22 cents on the dollar, starting to see maybe some movement northward. So we want to see a few more years of these great commodity prices starting to move that working capital, rebuild that liquidity out there in the sector. But it's nice to see a little bit of breathing room. 20 cents on the dollar, that's kind of like the low end. That's where you don't want to breach. In the 1980s, we were down to, you know, less than 10 cents on the dollar of working capital to expenses. So we're at a healthy level, but I'd like to see us maybe even get a little bit higher. If you look at interest expense as a percentage of earnings, so how many cents of every dollar of farm earnings gets eaten up by interest expense, we're at a very, very healthy level. So the peak during the farm crisis years was about 35 cents. That's when interest rates were really high, variable rates, and earnings dropped considerably. Today, we're at something more like 10 to 12 cents. Modest levels, very manageable levels. And I think our new normal is going to be right around that 13 cents to 15 cents mark. So we're going to hold that level. Given where interest rates are and the outlook for interest rates. And that's a very good level to handle the amount of debt load that farmers in the farm economy started to generate the last couple of years. In terms of performance, you know, I say a lot of those indicators that we like to look at, bankruptcy rates, delinquency rates, all of those things are trending in a very positive number. So Chapter 12 bankruptcies, for example, either if you're looking at it by percentage of farms or by just number of farms going through that very difficult Chapter 12 process, those are both down dramatically in 2020 and 21. A lot of that has to do with some of the excess cash that came from the government support program payments, but then also followed up by really strong commodity prices this year. So both of those things helping cure some of these delinquency and bankruptcy issues that were popping up in 2020. And the other thing I like to look at is delinquency rates. So using farm banks and commercial banks all across the country to estimate how many loans are past due more than 90 days. And so you can break that up by county and by region. And what you see here is based on the last year of data, so the second quarter 2021, delinquency rates are down almost across the board. So a negative number means that fewer people are behind on their farm debt. So all across the Midwest, the Heartland, the Northern Grains, the Prairie Gateway, a lot of healing in delinquency rates. The one place there's not, and you've heard it mentioned a couple times already today, the Basin Range, where there's been drought and you know, cattle prices haven't fully recovered from the pandemic, you still see some elevated levels of delinquencies there. But everywhere else where you've got a lot higher commodity prices and a lot of cash flow from those government support program payments in 19 and 20, you have seen that show up in lower default rates, lower delinquency rates in commercial banks. Looking forward, so it's not all about looking back. I like to also say, hey, here are the things that I'm keeping an eye on from either a farm financial perspective or a policy perspective that might influence what's going on in farm finances. Inflation is going to hang around, right? So we're not, we got a little reprieve maybe in August, but you're seeing it start to inch up into the farm expense line items, and that may continue to be a downward pressure on profitability into 22. The Fed is where we're going to be learning more and more about what the Fed might do in terms of monetary policy in the coming weeks and then months. And that could have a lot of impact on what happens to farm finances and infrastructure as well. So that's going to be more policy that comes out and that we know more about in the coming months that could dramatically improve or hinder some of the financial healings that we're seeing on the farm. And with that, the flip side between all that great infrastructure spend is maybe some tax offsets to help pay for it. So that could influence what happens to real estate values as well as what happens to profitability on the farm. And finally, all of this kind of mixes together to affect the value of the U.S. dollar, and that directly impacts how much we sell overseas, our export demand, and that's going to drive commodity prices. So all these things are going to work together to influence U.S. dollar, and that can have a big impact on farm finances and the financial sector for agriculture in 22.
You can find more on that at agripulse.com. That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.